This is the Does God Exist Bi-Monthly Journal for January-February 2014. John Clayton is your reader. The cover of our bi-monthly for this particular issue is a picture in outer space. It shows various nebula and clouds of floating hydrogen gas. And our lead article for this issue is titled Pluralism in Astronomy. Aristotle taught the people of his day that the Earth was fixed in place at the center of the universe. This view had religious appeal because it put humans at the center of everything, and therefore indicated they are superior to all other things. For many years, people believed that Genesis 1 supported this view. Humans were special and had dominion over everything else. Stars were fixed points of light that gave directions and filled the night sky. The ancients knew that there were wandering stars. Unlike the fixed point of light, these stars moved in an arc across the sky. They were called planets, which mean wandering stars. In order to maintain the Aristotelian view, early astronomers invented epicycles, curves along which the wandering stars moved. Copernicus proposed that the observation of astronomy would fit a model in which the Earth circled the Sun and rotated about its own axis. This was a huge change, because now the Earth was a world rather than the world. The planets, or wandering stars, now had something in common with Earth. We all circle the Sun. Many saw all this as a principle of mediocrity, indicating that there is nothing special about our planet. By extension, that meant that there was nothing special about Earth's inhabitants. If there is nothing special about Earth, then it seemed logical to assume the wandering stars, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, would be similar to Earth in other ways, including intelligent life. The 18th century French astronomer Jerome Valandy wrote, quote, "There is every possible resemblance between the planets and the Earth. Is it then rational to suppose the existence of living and thinking beings is confined to the Earth?" End of quote. By 1800, most intellectuals believed in pluralism, that possibly every planet had intelligent beings living on it, and that every star had planets, all of which housed intelligent life. There were even serious scientists, including William Herschel, who discovered Uranus, Carl Friedrich Gauss, David Brewster, and Norman Lockyer, who proposed that solarians lived on the Sun. In 1895, the Italian astronomer Giotto Schiaparelli proposed intelligently made features on Mars. This led to Percival Lowell's photographs of canals on Mars. The Wall Street Journal in 1907 wrote, quote, "The most extraordinary development of 1907 has been the proof afforded by astronomical observations of the year that conscious, intelligent life exists on the planet Mars. There could be no more wonderful achievement than this, to establish the fact of life on another planet." End of quote. Atheists seized on this to attack the Bible and Christianity. Thomas Paine had written in his 1794 book, Age of Reason, quote, "To believe that God created a plurality of worlds, at least as numerous as what we call stars, renders the Christian system of faith at once little and ridiculous. From whence, then, should arise a solitary and strange concept that the Almighty, who had millions of worlds equally dependent on his protection, should quit the care of all the rest and come to die in our world, because, they say, one man and one woman had eaten an apple." End of quote. Paine wrote that it was ridiculous to assume Jesus traveled from world to world in an endless succession of deaths. The first 19th century scientist to oppose this pluralism was William Whewell of the University of Cambridge, who interestingly invented the word scientist. In an 1853 essay, he pointed out that there was no sound evidence to support extraterrestrial intelligence. Alfred Russel Wallace, who was the co-discoverer of the theory of evolution, supported Whewell's views and gave evidence to support it. In our time, we have had attempts to resurrect this pluralism concept. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence, that's SETI, S-E-T-I, assumes an updated form of pluralism. Popular movies like Star Trek, Star Wars, Avatar, and others have built on this thing. In the past 50 years, science has discovered that there is astonishing diversity in our solar system. Some planets, like Jupiter, do not even have a surface, but are made mostly of gas and limited amounts of liquid. For that reason, we call them Jovian planets. Some planets are rocky, like Earth, but have a small mass. They cannot hold a significant atmosphere. Earth has a large moon to stabilize its axis of rotation and influence our tides, and plate tectonics, which are vital to the existence of life. The importance of shielding to protect the surface of a planet from bombardment by space debris, such as asteroids and comets, has become more obvious with new scientific observations. For example, we have seen Jupiter intercepting these objects before they can come close to Earth, and we have also seen how destructive such a collision can be with our studies of the asteroid that apparently did strike the Earth during the Cretaceous geological period. That impact caused massive extinction of life, including the dinosaurs. Leading scientists are now challenging the concept of astronomical pluralism. An example is British physicist Stephen Webb's book, quote, "If the universe is teeming with aliens, where is everybody?" End of quote. Mike Brown, professor of planetary astronomy at Caltech, who discovered Eris, the dwarf planet beyond Pluto, in an interview on NPR's All Things Considered, that was on April 1st, 2010, discussed, quote, "the fruitless search for solar systems like ours," end of quote. Astrophysicist Howard Smith wrote an article in Scientific American in 2011 titled, quote, "Alone in the Universe." The purpose of this article is not to say that there is no life in space. The Bible does not address this question, but makes it clear that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to God except through him. I am reminded of a radio discussion and debate I had some 40 years ago on a program called Encounter. The program was hosted by a rising star in the radio industry named Larry King. A caller asked the atheist representative on the show with me what he would do if a spaceship landed in the White House lawn and a little green man jumped out with a Bible in his hand and said, "Has Jesus been here yet?" That question was rooted in the same misconception that Thomas Paine had about the nature of God. But I used it then and use it now to make a point. The message of Christ in Matthew 5-7 is a message of love, caring, peace, giving, compassion, sharing, supporting, and consistent concern for the well-being of others. If there are other sentient beings out there somewhere, they need to hear the message. Naturalism and moralities based on survival of the fittest do not work. If Christianity is tried, it does work. My atheist colleague on the show gave a short and intelligent answer. He said, quote, "Punt. Indeed, we need to see the earth as special, needing to be cared for, and its people desperately needing what Jesus Christ has to offer." Are we genetic robots? As Darwin recognized, we humans are the first and only species able to escape the brutal force that created us. Natural selection. We alone on Earth have evolved to the point where we can overthrow the tyranny of natural selection. That's a quote from Richard Dawkins' television series The Fifth Ape, Episode 2, The Genius of Charles Darwin. That was in August of 2008. The past 25 years have seen incredible progress in our understanding of genetics. As the human genome has been compared to that of other living things, it has become apparent that what distinguishes us is not our genetic makeup. Our genome is over 90% the same as many other forms of life, but it is clear that our culture is not 90% the same as any other form of life on this planet. It is also true that our culture has evolved. The way we live is completely different from the way humans lived 500 years ago, and how they lived then was radically different from how people lived 5,000 years ago. This is not true of other forms of life. Chimpanzees today live exactly as chimpanzees lived 10,000 years ago. Atheists would maintain that this cultural evolution is totally due to the evolution of the brain. The idea is that the brain evolved, and when it reached a certain point, the brain took over. The problem with this proposal is that we do not see evidence of genetic evolution in humans, even though changes in phenotype, which is the outward appearance, are apparent. We also do not see humans as having a prerogative on brain characteristics. Our brain is not the largest in the animal kingdom, nor does it have sections that do not exist in other forms of life. It is important to examine the unique characteristic of humans. Animals can think, solve problems, reason, communicate, have emotions, and have social structures. We have a tendency to anthropomorphize animals, in other words, to ascribe human emotions to animal behaviors. When a dog cowers, it is not an act of repentance and sorrow. It is an act of submission. Walt Disney may have done us a disservice when he gave us deer and rabbits weeping or jumping for joy. This anthropomorphism is pitched to us daily in such things as the gecko lizard and the polar bears and their bottle of Coke. The things that are unique to humans include our capacity to worship, to create in abstractions, to be able to be taught to think, to learn, to organize, to teach, to express ourselves in musical and artistic creations, and to create and build unique complex structures. All of these abilities go beyond what is in our genes. These abilities have had an effect upon our biology as well as on our culture. We live twice as long as we used to. We have new diseases and have escaped some old ones. We have modified our way of living from agricultural to urban. We have also escaped dependence on natural selection, as Dawkins claims. When the Bible says we are created in the image of God, Genesis 1:26-28, the words in Hebrew are chosen to give a specific meaning which is completely different from the description of the physical creation of humans in chapter 2. In chapter 2:7, we are told that man was formed of the dust of the earth. The verb used here is yachur, indicating something like what a potter would do using natural physical materials to form a final product. The formation of humans by the genome, or the pattern, the potter, is following. In Genesis 1:27, the verb used is bara, indicating a process only God can do, and in the image of God himself, a spiritual image, John 4:24. This is further emphasized in what God tells mankind this unique creation will allow. Quote, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living creature that moves upon the earth. Genesis 1:28. In Genesis 2:15, God tells the man to dress and keep the garden. The final awakening of humans comes with the ability to choose good or evil, obedience or disobedience. Up until that time, humans could make physical choices, but their moral sense was not awakened. Animal behavior is genotypically driven and does not change. The mating dances of birds are the same as they were 1,000 years ago. The chemical signaling of ants is as it was when life first appeared on Earth. Bees signal, wolves howl, penguins nest on ice, salmons migrate, sharks hunt, and bats catch bugs as they did thousands of years ago. We may disrupt some of these behaviors, but when the disruption is removed, the behavior returns. Our social problems are not genetically driven. War is not inevitable. Alcohol use is a choice, not a robotically driven disease from which we cannot escape. Abuse, sexual behavior, food habits, smoking, drug use, and education, or lack of it, are all things we have the capacity to control. We are not genetically programmed to destructive behaviors. If we understand and believe that, we can change ourselves and the world around us for the better. Science and Faith, Enemies or Friends, by Godwin Oriyami Adeboye. A little editor's note here. The Does God Exist ministry gives $1,000 scholarships every year to post-secondary education. To win the scholarship, participants must enter a 5,000-word or less essay on an announced topic. In 2013, the topic was Science is a Friend of Faith, Not an Enemy. Our winning essay for 2013 was submitted by Godwin Oriyami Adeboye of the Igbaja Kawa State in Nigeria, Africa. We've made a few changes to the grammar and the cultural structure of the essay, but the rest of it is his writing. In the 20th century, there was a widespread conviction that a trend towards secularization inevitably goes hand in hand with the development of a modern industrialized society. Accordingly, there was much talk about the impossibility of a modern scientific mind believing in God. Rudolf Bultmann and other radical theologians went so far as to claim that it is not possible to use electric lights and modern gadgets and at the same time believe in the biblical faith and miracles. Other scholars also concluded that science and faith are in conflict. The basic challenge is whether science undermines religious faith, or whether there are particular tenets of religion that are at odds with some tenets of science. My point in this paper is that science and faith are not enemies, but friends. Evolutionary biologists like Richard Dawkins append that religious and scientific claims are not reconcilable. However, the much-hyped conflict between faith and science is really a conflict between men of science and men of religion, rather than science and religion themselves. Faith tries to answer the question of why nature exists and who is behind it, while science tells us how nature goes. Science and faith do not, therefore, seem to be essential rivals. In view of this argument, we will be doing a critical assessment of some scientific theories with a keen interest and reconciling them with some religious facts. Evolution and biblical creation. How should we discuss the seeming contradictions between the scientific theory of evolution and the biblical concept of special creation? First, how shall we deal with the apparent conflict between what the Bible says about the origin and development of the universe and what the scientific theory of evolution seems to tell us about the same subject? Some people have taken evolution to what could be called evolutionism. They have made evolution to be what philosopher Alvin Plantinga calls the crucial myth of our secular culture. The theory of evolution plays a fascinating and crucial role in contemporary Western culture. Evolution has become the regular subject of courtroom drama and public debate. In academia, it is the idol of the contemporary time. It serves as the litmus test distinguishing the ignorant and bigoted fundamentalist from the properly cultured and scientifically informed individual. Oxford biologist and well-known atheist Richard Dawkins wrote, quote, "If superior creatures from space ever visit our universe, the first question they will ask, in order to assess the level of our civilization, is have they discovered evolution yet?" This assertion shows the importance of the evolution-creation debate. The Bible teaches that God created the heavens and the earth and all forms of life on it by his sovereign power and will. The Hebrew word bara is translated create in English. The word bara is used in the Bible for a special act of creating out of nothing, which can occur only through instrumentality of God. From the historical evaluation of biblical facts, some Bible students believe the earth is only 6,000 years old. On the other hand, evolutionists say that life arose via a process which started from simple to complex forms. They believe that life originated from a unicellular organism such as bacteria to a more complex life and eventually to mammals and man. This denotes that all life descended from organisms that lived in the past. Scientists call this common ancestry theory, indicating we are literally cousins of all living things. The main issue in the evolution-creation debate is the evolutionary claim of natural selection and its dependency upon genetic mutation as the sole mechanism through which all living organisms evolved. The principle of natural selection is vital to evolution. Atheistic evolutionists not only take evolution as a proven fact, but also take the theory to undermine the possibility of any external monitoring agent on the evolutionary process. A cursory look at the issues in evolution will make it clear that evolution itself does not exclude a concept of external monitoring agents, like God. From the viewpoints of evolution and creation, one can notice some apparent conflict between assertions of the Bible and that of science. But are they really in conflict? The first seeming conflict is the age of the earth. While evolutionists propose billions of years, some creationists suggest 6,000 years, even though the Bible does not literally mention the age of the earth. The assumption that the earth is 6,000 years old is based on a genealogical study of scriptural records, connected with some biblical history. The first two verses, Genesis 1, 1 and 2, which are critical to this discussion and need clarification to solve this apparent contradiction between science and faith. What does the Bible really say from an unbiased exegetical engagement of the text? From Genesis 1, 2, Victor Hamilton mentions the three words that are very important to ascertain the age of the earth from the biblical perspectives. These are tohu, bohu, and haya. The Hebrew word haya, H-A-Y-A-H, means to become or was. When used in relationship to the other two words, tohu and bohu, which mean chaos or without form in English, It can be translated, quote, it became or was formless or chaotic, end of quote. In regard to the word earth, Hebrew word eretz, E-R-E-T-S, as the subject in Genesis 1-2, the text can be rendered, quote, the earth became or was formless and empty, end of quote, as the appropriate interpretation of the text. This fact suggests that there are two stages of creation, the original creation of the universe in Genesis 1-1, and then the process of bringing order out of the disordered chaos in verse 2. The first creation in Genesis 1-1 can be up to 15 billion years old, as the scientific claim purports. This perspective, and the fact that the age of the earth is not mentioned literally in the Bible, solves the apparent science-faith conflict about the age of the earth. There is another useful concept that is worthy to note in determining the age of the earth and examining the contradictions between the Bible's special creation and the scientific claim of continuous evolution. It is the biblical usage of the word yom, which means day in English. This word appears more than 2,000 times in the Old Testament. This word is used in a variety of ways in the Bible. It can be used in regard to daylight in a diurnal cycle, or it can mean a normal 24-hour day, or it can mean an indefinite period of time, such as in Psalms 90 and verse 10. The best methodology in hermeneutics and exegesis is to use the Bible to interpret the Bible. This methodology is useful to examine the word yom in Genesis and its usage of its Greek equivalent, hemero. In 2 Peter 3 and 8, one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, end of quote. In the epistle of Peter, the word day is used in reference to a long period of time. So the word yom, as used by Moses in the creation account, may not have been a 24-hour day. The longevity of day in Genesis time may not have been equal to the duration of day in our time. Similarly, naming all of the animals by Adam in just a day is enough to understand the Genesis day is beyond a 24-hour day. The day as used in Genesis could be a very long period of time corresponding to the major periods of the evolutionary geological history. The implication to this fact is that the period between the time of the beginning and the end of God's creation need not just be 6 24-hour days. The Genesis account of creation does not necessarily denote the concept of instantaneous creation, but one that happens in stages, possibly over eons, which is the same as what evolutionists claim. It would be a red herring to claim that the interpretation of the word yom in Genesis as a 24-hour day is the most spiritual and most conservative interpretation. Interpreting it as indefinite periods of time is hermeneutically appropriate. Even the Talmudic tradition, which contains commentaries on virtually every passage in the Old Testament, is not in support of 24-hour periods for the days in the creation story. However, a clarification is needed at this junction. We have to strip evolution of a naturalistic coat that has been given to it by the atheistic evolutionist. By doing this, we will be able to see whether evolution's claims really contradict the concept of creation as we have it in the Bible. We will give attention to this clarification next. Evolution, evolutionist, and evolutionism. It is easy to see that what we could call evolutionism is not as much science as it is a philosophy of science. Evolutionism is philosophically constructed upon the foundation of naturalism. The naturalistic evolutionists reflect their metaphysical presupposition, which is the image of their atheistic conceptions. Simply put, evolutionism is what the evolutionists have made evolution to become as a result of their presuppositions. One such presupposition is that God has left nothing to do in the world, and all beliefs in him are therefore unnecessary. Because of their preconceived prejudice about the existence of God, they have replaced what might be the intervention of God in the evolutionary process with their atheistic color natural selection. The evolutionists are not religiously neutral. Rather, they are religiously biased. As stated by Alvin Plantinga, there are two presuppositions that underlie the views of evolutionists. On the one hand, there is the perennial naturalism, a view according to which there is no God. Secondly, there is what can be termed enlightenment humanism. If we can remove these notions that have been imposed on evolution by atheistic evolutionists or ill-informed scientists, then the remaining evolutionary fact is never an enemy to the biblical concept of creation. The clash is not between evolution and biblical creation, but it concerns the nature of scientific philosophy employed by some scientists. As long as atheistic scientists and philosophers assume that matter is eternal and thus needs no creator, they can easily leave God out of the picture, even when evolution is pointing to divine intervention in its process. So the evolutionists presuppose that natural selection is the only mode through which evolutionary trends are guided. One of the major theories postulated by Dr. Johnson Phillip of the Graduate School of Apologetics and Theology in India is that one's presuppositions cannot be separated from the theological conclusions that he or she makes. Some neo-Darwinists have pressed too far on their doctrine of natural selection because of their preconceived prejudice presuppositions. The evolutionists use the concept of natural selection to conclude that God does not exist. However, Professor Coutre of the University of Chicago has said, quote, "The most fundamental objection to the theory of natural selection is that it does not deal with the question of the origin of life, but how life developed. This is very important. The concept of natural selection hangs on the theory of transmutation, which itself has some theoretical challenges. However, natural selection can only act on mutations in living things. It cannot explain where the life came from." Another expression of the spirit of naturalism and atheism of evolutionists can be seen in their concept of the abiogenesis of life. Abiogenesis is the hypothetical natural process by which life came from simple organic compounds. They argue that the origin of life is abiotic, though they cannot tell us clearly the nature of their proposed prebiotic soup. As one author wrote, "The improbability that the specific coding information inherent in genetic materials of the living system could have arisen spontaneously seems to be well recognized. The specificity of genetic code and the chirality, the right-left-handedness, of biomolecules have elevated the level of complexity in living system from that of a periodic order of crystals to the informational organization of human language. Therefore, all chemical evolutionary scenarios require prebiotic production of the informational biomolecules. These enzymatically active RNA ribonucleic acids, called ribozymes, have rapidly taken the center stage in the discussion of prebiotic evolution. Ribozymes serve as the attractive model which possesses both the capacity of coded information, which is normally associated with nucleic acid, and the capacity of informational transfer, which is carried out by proteins. However, the difficulties faced by the ribozyme hypothesis are not less impressive. The scarcity of the supply of ribonucleotide building blocks in the prebiotic environment, the chirality of riboses, and the specific Y5 phosphodiester linkage are among these obstacles." By the way, when I read a quote like that, it's pretty complicated. It has a footnote. And if you're interested in where that's been taken from, if you let us know, we can send it to you. I won't read it because it's just scientific journals that are being referenced. Continuing. "These impressive difficulties are enough to falsify the concept of abiogenesis. In addition, the stipulation of the abiogenesis of life under conditions different from the present universe has removed the theory from empirical sciences. It can neither be verified nor falsified under the present condition of the earth. In view of this, the theory of abiogenesis and natural selection as the cardinals of evolution are themselves not totally free from scrutiny. We might say that natural selection can only be the editor rather than the composer of genetic messages, as demanded by neo-Darwin evolutionists. Accordingly, directional natural selection is not the driving force of macroevolution and abiogenesis. Rather, it is the hand of the maker using his own selected method and bringing the universe to what it is. It can thus be seen that it is not the Bible versus science, but Bible versus scientist in this context, evolutionist. Stripping evolution of its clothes given to it by evolutionists will solve a lot of the seeming conflict between evolution and the biblical concept of creation. Simply put, the discussions of evolutionist and evolutionism is deeply embedded in philosophical and naturalistic humanism. Atheistic evolutionists are influenced by the dominant culture and reasoning patterns of the post-Enlightenment. Darwinian evolution, strictly speaking, begins after the first life has developed. This does not necessarily refute the claim that there should be a concept of first cause in the creation of the universe that stands outside of the creation. Richard Pollack, a professor of biological science at Columbia University, wrote, quote, "If you know someone who says the throne of God is empty," in other words, that God does not exist, and lives with that, then you know that you should cling to that person as a good friend. But be careful. Almost everyone who says that has already placed something or someone else on that throne, usually himself. End of quote. This is, in fact, true of atheistic evolutionists. Scientific terms and biblical terms. Another wedge used to draw the camel's head into the tent by those who propose that faith and science are enemies is that most scientific terms are not found in the Bible. One should not expect the Bible to relate its divine truth in scientific terms, because it is not a scientific textbook, but a divine book with different purpose. Howard Van Til supports this when he writes, "We have to respect God's choice for the historical and cultural context in which the biblical texts were written. It was God's choice to accommodate this mode of expressing himself to the historically and culturally limited conceptual vocabulary of the day. While the Bible articulates the concepts of the created world, science articulates its description." End of quote. God was purposeful in the vocabulary he used to express himself through the biblical writers. Though they were inspired by God, biblical writers did not have terms like galactic redshift, thermonuclear fusion, plate tectonics, stellar evolution, ionizing radiation, atomic spectra, DNA, genetic drift, entropy, or even water cycle. Though these terms are not literally found in the Bible, many of them can be directly inferred and are inherent in biblical passages. For example, the concept of the water cycle can be seen in Jeremiah 10:13 and 51:16, where the prophet says, quote, "When he uttered his voice, there was a multitude of waters in the heavens, and he caused the vapors to ascend to the end of the earth. He makes lightning with rain and brings forth the wind out of his treasures." End of quote. This one verse clearly outlines the four aspects of the hydraulic system: evaporation, wind, lightning, and rain. These verses show that the Bible did not literally mention scientific terms. It discussed the scientific phenomena in biblical language. The purpose of writing the Bible was never to develop theories. It was God's attempt to create the possibility of having a good relationship with his creatures. It would be misguided to expect Scripture to use the kind of statements and terms that would be the same as that of contemporary science. The writers of the Bible conveyed their message to their contemporaries using the language and customs of their time. It is therefore unreasonable to expect Moses to describe his creation account in 21st century language. If the language of the Bible were to be that of modern science, people in a former age would not have understood it. The purpose of the Mosaic creation account is not to teach scientific terms, but to give in a brief manner an account of the beginning of the universe that people of any age can understand. Scientific facts are found in the Bible. One of the arresting evidences for a non-conflicting science-faith relationship is the number of scientific facts that have lain hidden within the pages of the Bible. A good example of this relates to the field of astronomy. For thousands of years, wise men have busied themselves with counting the stars and the constellations. Before the invention of scientific equipment, such as the telescope in the 17th century, a number of stars was regarded as practically determined. According to the great Ptolemy, the number was around 1,056. Tycho Brahe gave 777, and Kepler counted 1,005. This assessment has been tremendously increased, and the end is not yet reached. It is now known that there are well over 100 billion stars in our own galaxy, and many in billions of other galaxies like our own. Recently, many astronomers agreed that it is not humanly possible to count all the stars. The Bible also asserts this in Jeremiah 33:22, quote, "The host of the heavens cannot be numbered," end of quote. In addition, Isaiah 40 and verse 22 corresponds with the scientific concept of the earth's sphericity, where the prophet says, quote, "It is he who sitteth upon the circle of the earth." The Hebrew word translated circle is khug, K-H-U-G, which can be translated circle or sphere or roundness. Similarly, the correlation between the science of meteorology and some biblical facts is noteworthy. For example, the water cycle is a fundamental fact of this field of science, where by water is precipitated as rain or snow, drained off by the river system into the oceans, raised by evaporation back into the skies, and carried by the wind back to the land to be again precipitated. As pointed out earlier in Jeremiah, this was clearly stated in the Bible ages before man discovered it. King Solomon, almost 3,000 years ago, in Ecclesiastes 1 verses 6 and 7, affirms that the wind goes to the north and south, and turneth about unto the north. It leadeth about continually, and the wind returned again to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, and the sea is not full. Unto the place from where the rivers come, they return again. End of quote. Elijah in Job 36:27-29 says, quote, for he draws up the drops of water which distill into rain from the vapor thereof, which the skies pour down and drop upon man abundantly. These passages are a most excellent summary of those phases of the hydraulic cycle involving the very marvelous physical process of evaporation, condensation, and precipitations. The subject of water supply and sewage disposal are of great interest and importance to both bacteriologists and civil engineers, as well as to the general public. It was not until a few score years ago that the significance of a clean and sanitary water supply in the prevention of disease was recognized. But Moses seemed to understand something of modern bacteriology because he forbade the drinking of water from smaller stagnant pools or waters that had been contaminated in Leviticus 11:29-36. The Word of God was scientifically accurate in this great biological truth penned thousands of years before man discovered it and elaborated on it. Henry Morris wrote about another example, quote, the basic principle of all physical science is that the law of conservation and deterioration of energy. The law of energy conservation states that in any transformation of energy in a closed system from one sort to another, the total amount of energy remains unchanged. A similar law is the law of mass conservation, which says that though matter may be changed in size, state, form, etc., the total mass cannot be changed. In other words, these laws teach that no creation or destruction of matter or energy is now being accomplished anywhere in the physical universe. These laws are of great and prime importance in all physical sciences. However, the Bible taught this thousands of years ago. These laws are related to the laws of thermodynamics, in which the principle of entropy increase is related. Entropy is a sort of mathematical abstraction, which is actually a measure of the non-availability of energy in the system. Because of the law of entropy increase, it is impossible to create a machine that is 100% efficient, and perpetual motion is not possible. The law also indicates that the universe had a beginning. Quote, if it is growing old, it must once have been young. If it is wearing out, it must once have been new. If it's running down, it must have once been wound up. In short, this law of energy degeneration conveys us back inexorably to the affirmation of the necessary truth of the existence of a creator. End of quote. The meticulous care and scrutiny by which peer review is carried out in the scientific process is a great virtue. Science is the search for knowledge and truth. But the Bible also supports this fact, as this can be seen in the biblical usage of words faith and defense. The Greek word pisteuo primarily has reference to an act of faith, while the noun form pistis depicts more clearly what faith means. A Greek-English lexicon by Lytle and Scott defines the noun as follows, quote, a means of persuasion, an argument, proof, end of quote. Pitho, P-E-T-T-H-O, in an active voice means to be fully persuaded. When these words are used in infinitive form with relationship to OTI, which means because, then it means to believe or to be convinced, end of quote. A good example of this is John 20 and verse 31. Be convinced that Jesus is the Lord, end of quote. In 1 Peter 3 verse 15, Peter calls upon all Christians to, quote, be ready to give an answer to every man who asks you a reason for the hope that is within you, end of quote. The Greek word apologia, make defense, followed by the dative noun, has reference to any kind of answer or justification, whether formal or informal. Another Greek word, logon, used by Peter here, means to ask a reason. By this statement, Peter laid his obligation of rational belief upon every child of God. Therefore, the Bible itself gives room for reasoning and defense for one's faith. The Apostle Paul also makes it clear that Christians are to prove or put to test their faith. Many people who tend to view their faith beliefs as a sacred cow that cannot be touched or need to shift from this dogmatic slumbering and wake up to embrace reasoning for what they believe. In 1 Thessalonians 5:21, Paul urged Christians to, quote, prove all things, end of quote. Also in Philippians 1 and verse 7, the term confirmation from the Greek word bebasos, B-E-B-A-I-O-S-I-S, is used to make a clear that reasoning is the justification for one's proposition. So are reasoning and faith enemies or friends? The evidence points to a friendly relationship. Conclusion. True faith, like good science, promotes a more measured rationality and more thoughtfulness. Faith is never the arrest of thought, but a fertile basis and constant provocation of thought. Ultimately, religion and science can interconnect and strengthen one another. A quote, the pioneering astronomer and mathematician Johannes Kepler, who first calculated the elliptical orbits of the planets, perhaps put it best when he wrote, the chief aim of all investigations of the external world should be to discover the rational order and harmony which has been imposed on it by God, and which he revealed to us in the language of mathematics. End of quote. It is not the work of science to speculate on the possibility of a supernatural cause, since such metaphysical considerations are out of the realm of scientific inquiries. No scientific theory, if well understood, including evolution, can pose any threat to religious beliefs. For those two great tools of human understanding operate in a complementary, not conflicting relationship. John Clayton quoted British physicist Lord Kelvin, who said, if you study science deep enough and long enough, it will force you to believe in God, end of quote. From these facts, one can be right to conclude with Stephen Jay Gould's concept of overlapping magisteria. That is, the roles played by science and faith are two distinct roles, but they are complementary, not contradictory. It is good to conclude this essay by mentioning Albert Einstein's famous assertion, science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. End of quote. Science and faith need each other and can work together. Scientist and God. And our scientist for this issue is Albert Einstein. From 1897 to 1955, theoretical physicist who developed the general theory of relativity. We have had Einstein's comments several other times in this column, and here are some additional statements. These are all quoted statements of Einstein. The deeper one penetrates into nature's secrets, the greater becomes one's respect for God. The most beautiful and profound emotion we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. It is the sower of all true science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger can no longer stand wrapped in awe and is as good as dead. That deeply emotional conviction of the presence of the superior reasoning power which is revealed in the incomprehensible universe forms my idea of God. My religiosity consists in a humble admiration of the infinitely superior spirit that reveals itself in the little that we, with our weak and transitory understanding, can comprehend of reality. In view of such harmony in the cosmos, which I, with my limited human mind, am able to recognize, there are yet people who say there is no God. What really makes me angry is that they quote me for support of such views. And finally, as a child, I received instruction in both the Bible and the Talmud. I am a Jew, but I am enthralled by the luminous figure of the Nazarene. I accept the historical Jesus unquestionably. No one can read the Gospels without feeling the actual presence of Jesus. His personality pulsates in every word. No myth is filled with such life. Cynthia's Corner by Cynthia Clayton. Our place in the creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. God created the earth as a humble habitat to sustain and nourish human beings. Of all the life forms God created on earth, humans are the only ones created, quote, in his image, end of quote, Genesis 1:26 through 27. What does that mean? That our bodies are in his image? Of course not. God is a spirit, John 4:24, and humans are created in his spiritual image. God gave us an eternal soul. What an amazing gift, and a gift he gave to none other of his other earthly creations. How do I know that? After God had created all of the other creatures on earth, he then created man specifically, quote, in his image, in his likeness, end of quote, Genesis 1:26. The Bible does not say that about any other creature on earth, Genesis 1:20 through 26. God then gave mankind specific instructions to be fruitful and increase, fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over every living creature. Genesis 1:26-28 and Psalms 8:6-8, this makes humans very special and unique among all of God's creations. God created us in His image as spiritual beings with the capacity to love and the desire to be loved. He gave us the ability to appreciate beauty and art, to create and to seek knowledge and understanding. We especially seek to know about our existence and our relationship to our Creator. Quote, He set eternity in the hearts of men, end of quote, Ecclesiastes 3:11. God did this so we would seek Him and find Him, Acts 17, beginning with verse 24 through 28. That part of us, which is in God's image, our eternal soul, yearns to know God and to be with God. My soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. That's a quote of Psalms 42, verses 1 and 2. We have a void within us that can only be filled with by God because of our spiritual makeup and because of God's nature. God is love, and love comes from God, John 1:4-7, 8, and 16. Quote, we love because God first loved us, 1 John 4:19, end of quote. Only God's love is perfect, and only God's perfect love can make us complete and whole, 1 John 2:5 and 1 Corinthians 13:10-13. God created humans uniquely to be loved by Him and to have a relationship with Him, even for eternity. He sent His Son to save the world, John 3:17, and He gave us His inspired word to know Him, Proverbs 2:1-6. God promises, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. Jeremiah 29:13. Daniel designs ants and survival rafts. How do insects like ants survive massive flooding? It would seem that when an ant colony is covered with 20 feet of water, that there would be no survivors. And yet, right after a flood, ant populations are as numerous as ever. The answer for some species of ants is that when the flood strikes, the ants will build a water-repellent raft that can stay afloat for weeks. Researchers at Georgia Tech have found that the fire ant species Solanopus invicta use their jaws, legs, and sticky pads to build a raft out of their bodies. As many as 200,000 ants can form rafts as big as 2 feet across, which are water-resistant because of the irregular shape of the raft. The ants' hairs trap air, creating buoyancy and forming a two-tiered structure. The ants that are on the bottom and underwater are still able to breathe because of the air bubbles trapped among the ants' bodies. Nathan Lott, who directed the study at Georgia Tech, says that studying the swarm intelligence that makes the raft seaworthy will give new insights into microbiotics and improved water repellency. One of the interesting challenges to a system like this is to explain its origin. On an evolutionary scale, one has to postulate that the ants accidentally found they could float and avoid drowning by locking onto each other. The origin and design of the ants' hairs, which trap the air bubbles, remains difficult to explain on a chance basis. That is, even if one accepts the notion that trying to survive afloat by grabbing onto others explains how the survival skill started. When scientists attempt to explain something like this, they have to make a series of assumptions. Skeptics then repeat the assumptions as if they are facts and say that the theory proposed is how it happened. We would suggest that God designed ants with the right equipment to build a raft and program them to utilize this method of survival when floods come to their area. We have to be reminded of Solomon's observation in Proverbs 6:6, quote, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide or overseer or ruler provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. The data for that is from National Geographic. The lucky or designed horseshoe crab. If we believe that God created the cosmos and everything in it, then God has a purpose for everything we see. Many times, the purpose of an animal or plant is not obvious to us. In recent months, there have been numerous articles in medical journals about the unique properties of the venom of poisonous snakes. And now it turns out that the chemicals in venom of some of the most deadly snakes known to man may give the answer to serious diseases affecting mankind. One of the seemingly most useless creatures on the earth is the horseshoe crab. This arthropod does not seem to have any purpose that would make humans want it around. You can't eat it, it's lousy bait, and since it is mostly shell, it is not even good fertilizer. This crab is so primitive that scientists believe it is related to the trilobite, one of the earliest animals to live on the earth. Scientists have now found that the blood of the horseshoe crab is one of the most important tools of modern medicine. Because of its ancient makeup, the blood of the horseshoe crab contains proteins that act like a primitive immune system. The blood is blue because it contains copper in its oxygen-carrying protein. The horseshoe crab's blood coagulates instantly when it touches pathogens, even bacteria like E. coli and Salmonella. The horseshoe crab's blood is so sensitive that it can detect pathogens as low as one part in a trillion, like a grain of sugar in an Olympic-sized pool. God created life on the earth to sustain mankind. The chemistry of animals is similar to ours. This allows us to eat meat and to have medicines that can relieve illnesses. The horseshoe crab is a good example of how a seemingly useless animal can have a major positive purpose in serving mankind. God's wisdom and design are seen all around us. The heavens really do proclaim the handiwork, and the earth and its creatures show his wisdom and design. Psalms 19:1. Again, the data is from National Geographic. News and notes. Atheists fight church tax exemption. The Freedom From Religion Foundation has a large ad in Scientific American, the first one in November 2013, it was also in the December issue, asking for donations to their legal fund to support three federal lawsuits against church-exempt status. What people don't think about in this type of action is what the consequences would be of taxing church property and church facilities. If you force all homeless shelters, food kitchens, counseling centers, medical facilities, women's shelters, daycare centers, elderly care centers, and church schools to pay taxes, you will cause a majority of them to close. Atheists don't run homeless shelters, soup kitchens, etc. So what would be the result of their actions? I have been told that welfare started when police in New York began addressing homeless immigrants because churches quit doing it. If atheists force churches to close those facilities, will we increase the debacle of tax-supported public welfare? In a related item, Christianity Today, October 13th, page 17, reports that the Justice Department has said that atheist leaders would qualify as ministers, getting the same tax breaks as ministers if they apply. More on closing church food kitchens. Christian Service Center in Lake City, Florida, has been distributing free food to needy people in their area for many years. On the wall of the church distribution center is a portrait of Christ, the Ten Commandments, and a banner that says, quote, Jesus is Lord. The center also gave free Bibles and prayed with needy folks who requested prayer. One of the sources of the free food was the United States Department of Agriculture, which the center used to get government cheese. The USDA's Florida official has ordered the center to take down all of its pictures, banners, and signs and stop the praying and the food distribution or give up USDA food. The center has given up the government food. Fox News said they had to choose God or government cheese, and it chose to trust God to provide. Data from that is Citizen Magazine, November 2013, page 8. Skull supports biblical claim. Skull 5, discovered in the village of Demisi in the nation of Georgia, has been hailed as significant because of the completeness of the fossil. Now analysis has created a stir because researchers have concluded that Skull 5 shows that there was only one lineage of early humans. The Bible indicates all humans have a common ancestry in Eve and Adam, and genetic studies have supported that view. Now there is fossil evidence to further support it. That was in The Week, November 1st, 2013, page 17, and also in USA Today, October the 18th, 2012. Another blow to anaerobic life claims. Those promoting a spontaneous start to life have been pretty much universal in assuming there was no oxygen in the early Earth. The problem is that oxygen would oxidize any carbon-based life that might be forming and thus destroy it. Experiments like the famous Miller-Urey synthesis of amino acids used an apparatus that excluded oxygen from the experiment. Scientists studying sediment in South America thought to be a billion years old have found evidence of atmospheric oxygen using a new chrome-52-53 method of detecting oxygen. This discovery is significant because it will throw out a number of theories about how life started. The question of how life began on Earth is an important mystery of design. This discovery adds to the evidence that chance is not the operative cause of life on Earth. The reference for this is Science News, October 19, 2013, page 12. Space travel and radiation dangers. In connection with solar activity, NASA has new data on the radiation hazards involved in going to the Moon and Mars. The Mars Science Laboratory delivered a Curiosity rover by traveling to Mars for 253 days. The first radiation detector to make the trip was on the spacecraft. Because the solar activity was low, scientists thought that radiation levels would not be prohibitively high. Even with these ideal conditions, a human going to Mars would get so much radiation that it would be like having a whole body CT scan every 5 or 6 days. It would be like a Hiroshima survivor experiencing that event 24 times. The dosage would be 66,240 millirem, which is what the average person on Earth gets in 184 years. This amount of radiation would increase a fatal cancer risk by 3 or 4%. We fail to realize how much shielding is built into the Earth's design by the atmosphere and the Earth's magnetic field. The data is from Astronomy Magazine, December 2013, page 12. Babies learn speech while in the womb. A study published in the October 26, 2013 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences describes an experiment that proves conclusively that babies start learning language long before they are born. The babies had a fake word, ta-ta-ta, blasted at them 5 to 7 times a week during their third trimester. When the babies heard the word 5 days after birth, they all had a neural jolt, which is called a mismatch response, associated with recognizing sound. Babies that had not heard the word during the mother's pregnancy did not make a response of any kind in hearing the word again after they were born. This research, conducted in Finland at the University of Helsinki, has many other implications. Can babies be taught words before birth? It is also a reminder that the unborn baby is not an extension of the mother's body, but a unique individual. This brings us again to ask if abortion is really infanticide and the destruction of a human being with potential. Reference is Science News, October 5, 2013, page 15. Adam and Eve chromosome data. As the human genome gets analyzed and refined, some interesting facts are emerging. Women's genetic heritage has been traced through mitochondrial DNA. For many years, geneticists have agreed that there was a single female ancestor to all humans on this planet, referred to as mitochondrial Eve. The male genetic line is more difficult to trace because the Y chromosome is very complicated. However, a study published in the October 2013 issue of Science Magazine reports on work by Carlos Bustamante of Stanford. He says that evidence indicates a single male ancestor for all humans, referred to as Y chromosome Adam. The authors are careful to say they don't support the two being a single couple, but their research shows the time when the Y chromosome Adam and the mitochondrial Eve lived is basically the same, suggesting 120,000 to 156,000 years ago. An evolutionary biologist at the University of Hawaii is quoted in the article as saying, quote, "People tied themselves up in knots to come up with an explanation," end of quote. It is interesting that as more and more data becomes available, both scientifically and biblically, the credibility of the account of Adam and Eve seems to gain ground. The data is from Science News, September 7, 2013, page 14. More Nessie nonsense. A widely used hoax that dominated our television is the Loch Ness Monster. When we were in Scotland, I found it interesting that people didn't believe in God, but they did believe in Nessie. However, those we met who live in the Loch Ness area had a very negative view of the claims of a monster in the lake. In the October 25, 2013 issue of The Week, page 40, there is a wonderful summary of the history and foolishness of the claim since 1822, when Loch Ness became part of the shipping channel. Latest Martian data reduces the chances of life on Mars. On Earth, most bacteria release methane as a byproduct of their biological functions. Scientists looking for life on Mars have been looking to verify the presence of methane in the Martian atmosphere. However, the Curiosity rover, which was equipped to precisely measure the amount of methane on Mars, found virtually no methane at all. Even though there are bacteria that don't produce methane, this will greatly reduce the chances of anybody finding active bacteria on the red planet. We do want to say again, however, that finding life on Mars has no biblical significance. However, it seems that the claims of abundant and pervasive life in the cosmos have been shown to be exaggerated at best. That was in The Week, October 11, 2013, page 22. Dinosaur fight preserved in stone. Two dinosaurs that were fighting with each other died in the midst of the fight and are now on display for sale at Bonhams in New York. One is a carnivore named Nanny Tyrannus, who had attacked a herbivorous dinosaur named Triceratops. The carnivore has a cracked skull, and 26 of his teeth have been found embedded in the body of the Triceratops. Those who claim the dinosaurs were all vegetarians and the carnivores didn't exist in early times do not have evidence on their side. It is clear in this case that one dinosaur was trying to eat the other. By the way, the asking price for the two fossils is $9 million. Reference for that is Popular Science, November 2013, page 30. Chimp and Human Differences. Educational Research Analysis Newsletter, October 2013, page 4, says that the claims of chimp and human DNA sequences being 99% identical are in error for the following reasons. Number one, rank, cherry picking. Low complexity sequence masking includes many non-aligning DNA fragments. Number two, statistical slant, focusing only on the most similar portions of the chimp and human genomes, exaggerated their total actual harmony. Number three, pre-rated synchronization. The longer the DNA sequence segments are compared, the lower we find the percentage of the matchups between the portions of chimp and human genomes. Number four, high discrepancy. 23% of the chimp and human sequences show no similarity. Chimp and human Y chromosome DNA sequences differ by over 30%, or about as much as human and chicken autosomes. Those are chromosomes whose genes are not sex-linked. 83% of amino acid sequences in chimp chromosomes, 22 differ from those in the human chromosome 21 counterpart. Conflicting descents, biochemical phylogenies of chimps, humans, gorillas, and orangutans contradict their standard anatomical phylogeny 40% of the time. Bloated percentage. Counting the gaps between closely aligned strands of chimp and human DNA sequences deflates the overall identify ratio between their respective genomes to 87%. Risky snap judgment. Any assured correspondence between the two genomes is premature and arbitrary. Unacknowledged functions of now omitted non-aligning DNA sequence sections may revolutionize comparisons. Students may find these comments useful as they study and evaluate the genome comparisons in their biology classes. Exorcism fiasco and Harry Potter spells. One advantage that atheists have going for them is the continued irresponsibility of people who claim to be Christians but engage in practices to make themselves wealthy by exploiting the weak, uneducated, or sick. Three American teenage girls are traveling the world, casting out evil spirits, and, quote, sexually transmitted demons, end of quote. Bryn Larson, who is the daughter of Barb Larson, the television demon exorcist, and Tess and Savannah Schirkenbach, have been attracting large crowds in London. Their methods involve using holy water and reciting spells from Harry Potter books. The BCC has produced a documentary titled Teen Exorcist. This will only contribute to the growth of atheism in the United Kingdom, Europe, and America. We had a featured story on exorcism in the May-June 2011 issue, and our video series programs 13 through 16 deal with this subject. The videos are available on DVDs or free online at DoesGodExist.tv. Past Does God Exist journals have also been found online at DoesGodExist.org. New mammoth find revives frozen specimen interest. A new find of a frozen mammoth in the Lushansky Islands off the Siberian coast has accelerated the studies of these incredible animals who lived over 10,000 years ago. This specimen had liquid blood and perfect muscle tissue. How it was preserved, how animals lived, and why they became extinct are all questions that scientists hope will be revealed as the specimens are studied. The animal stood up to 13 feet tall and weighed up to 10 tons. Man's role and the changes on the Earth in the past, such as global warming, should become better understood through finds such as this. That was in the Dallas Morning News, May 31st, 2013, page 10A. Military oaths attacked by atheists. We have mentioned in the Military Religious Freedom Foundation before in this journal. This is a group of atheists who are trying to remove any reference to God from military oaths and chaplaincies. The Air Force Academy has had, quote, "So help me God," in the quote at the end of its honor oath. As of October 25th, 2013, that has been removed. There already is no religious component in the pledges at Annapolis or West Point. That's from Time Magazine, November 11, 2013, page 13. Sun activity at a low. Every 11 years or so, the sun has a period of maximum activity measured in terms of the number of sunspots that are observed. In April of 2000, the 23rd solar cycle produced 121 sunspots, and a variety of effects were observed on the Earth due to that activity in the sun. The expected peak in solar activity in the current cycle was to occur in February of 2012. That peak turned out to be very weak, producing only 67 sunspots. The magnetic field strength of the sun and the polarity of the field in the sun varies widely in these periods of solar activity. Space travel, weather, and a variety of electronic considerations are affected by sun activity. We are still learning about the sun and how these cycles function. Those who try to use solar activity and magnetism to calculate the age of the sun are not doing very good science because this process is cyclic, not a one-time thing. Data for this is from Science News, November 2, 2013, page 24. Well, that's the end of the bi-monthly journal for January-February 2014. We hope that you enjoyed hearing these articles and that your faith is encouraged and strengthened. And in 60 days, we'll be back to you with the March-April issue of this bi-monthly journal. This is John Clayton, thanking you for listening.